that he moved here on his own. He told me this was his grandfather's place, and for whatever reason, my mind decided that he inherited it as an adult and moved here. But now, I back up in my mental process, piecing together what I know to create a timeline of Cassidy's life. First, there was the portrait that Cassidy removed. I recall that it was taken in 1995 when he was 5. It was of him, his mother, and his much older father. Second, there is the photo of his Little League triumph when he was 7, and the caption mentions his parents living in Millinocket, so they hadn't moved here yet. Third, I know that Cassidy's mother died 13 years ago when Cassidy was 14. Since I'm staying in her room and wearing some of her clothes, I think I can safely assume she lived here when she passed away. So he didn't move here as an adult. He moved here when he was still a child, sometime between the ages of 7 and 14, probably with his parents, but definitely with his mother. Which means Cassidy wasn't the one who chose this lifestyle. He just chose to stay. Still hugging A Prayer for Owen Meany to my chest, I turn away from the books and head back to my room, wondering why he never returned to the world, and wondering why his mother left it. I am on chapter 4 when I hear the front door open and close, and I'm surprised by the shot of adrenaline I get. I'm so happy, I feel like a firefly at dusk, bright from the inside. Cassidy's home. I hear him place something on the coffee table in the living room before appearing in my doorway, his body covered with dust and dirt, a mining helmet on his head.
You're awake, he says.
I am. You're back.
I am,
he answers grimly. How was your hike? He sighs.
Okay, I guess.
What's the benefit? I ask.
Of what?
Hiking at night?
It's quiet. Peaceful. I don't know.
He shrugs off the question, looking irritated.
How are you feeling?
Fine. Better every day. But he seems out of sorts. Everything okay with you?
I need a shower, he says, turning away. Then I'll make you some breakfast.
I'm feeling better. Really, I can help.
Don't worry about it,
he says over his shoulder, already walking away. I watch him go, but I don't get the usual thrill from watching his tight ass saunter away. He's upset about something, and I find that bothers me a lot more than I would have expected. Then, something terrible occurs to me. Maybe I've become a burden to him. Maybe he wishes I wasn't here. Having to care for me means he doesn't have the freedom to come and go as he wants. He has to be back here every few hours to check up on me, and I've been here for a while now. How long? 4 days? 5? 3 days unconscious, 3 more since the fever, plus today... 7. 7 days. I've been here for a week, which means that today is... Oh, God, I murmur. Today is June 26th. Today is Jem's 30th birthday. I close my eyes and breathe deeply through my nose, filling my lungs as much as I can without pulling the stitches. When I open them again, Katahdin stands tall and strong before me, and I am surprised by the deep sense of peace I feel staring back at it. Yes, my eyes are teary, but my breath doesn't catch, and my heart doesn't ache. Jem is gone, but I am still alive. What happened with Wayne was horrifying, but being in a life-threatening situation made me realize that I want this life. I want it very much, and I am grateful to Cassidy for preserving it. I feel tears slide down my cheeks, but I let them fall. Goodbye, Jem, I think, staring at the soft peaks of his favorite mountain. I wish I could have left a part of you up on Katahdin, but I know there will always be a part of you there. Your spirit will find its way back to the place you loved above all others.
Bryn?
I turn to see Cassidy, wet hair, bare feet, and a clean change of clothes standing in the doorway. He scans my face, and his instantly registers distress.
What's wrong?
He asks, covering the distance between us in two steps, his mismatched hawk eyes scanning mine.
Why are you crying? What happened? Are you okay?
It's Jem's birthday today.
Oh.
He sighs, sitting down slowly beside me, careful not to nudge my hip.
I'm sorry.
Me too, I say, tracing Cassidy's face with my eyes. He clenches his jaw, his gaze stormy as he turns away from me.
I went to look for it. The backpack. The phone.
What? I say, leaning forward a little, my breath catching, my heart racing.
That's what I was doing last night,
he mutters.
But I failed you.
My chest is so tight, so full as I process this knowledge, I don't know what to do. My fingers dig into the sheets, curling like they're trying to keep themselves from... You failed me? By doing something so insanely kind and thoughtful? How did you fail me?
It was gone,
he says softly, looking up at me with bleak, haunted eyes.
I looked all over the lean-to and in the woods surrounding it, underneath branches and leaves. I wanted to find it for you. I wanted you to be able to...
My fingers fly from the sheets, and I lurch forward, flinging my arms around Cassidy's neck and pulling him against me. I am undone by the hugeness of his heart, by the unselfishness of his spirit. You went back, I sob, close to his ear. His arms wrap around me, holding me close, and I lay my cheek on his shoulder. My breath fans his neck as I cry. His throat rumbles close to my lips, and I feel the vibrations of it as he speaks.
I climbed back up, but it wasn't...
Oh, Cass, I whisper, closing my eyes, because now I am crying in earnest, my tears wetting his t-shirt. You didn't have to do that.
I wanted to, he replies.
14 miles?
No, about 12, round trip. I had to go a safer way when I was carrying you, and that added miles. The way I went last night was steeper, but faster.
12 miles, I say, my voice breaking. For me. His arms tighten around me, and we hold each other as to a lifeline. His face shifts slightly, and I think he is pressing his lips to my head, but I'm not sure. The thought makes a sharp sensation rip through me, and I clench almost forgotten muscles deep inside, a wave of pure carnal desire for him making my head spin, making me dizzy. I want you, like I've never wanted anyone before. You didn't fail me, I say, the words breathless and emotional.
I didn't get the phone. It was gone.
Cassidy, I say, leaning away so I can look up at his face. My eyes get caught on his lips, and I stare at them, timelines converging. If he came to this cabin when he was so young, has anyone ever kissed them? Has anyone ever loved them? The thought of being his first kiss is so arousing, I whimper softly before skimming my gaze to his eyes.
You okay?
He asks. I swallow as I nod. My breathing is rapid and shallow. If he is truly that inexperienced, he doesn't need me kissing him right now while we're discussing Jem. Cassidy's first kiss shouldn't be shared with memories of another man. I take a deep breath to calm myself, but it makes my breasts rasp against his chest. I feel my nipples pucker and bead under my t-shirt, scraping against his rock-hard abs through two layers of cotton. Can he feel them? Does the touch of them affect him like his body is affecting mine? Thank you for trying to find it, I say, reaching up to cup his cheek. His eyelids flutter for a moment, then open. He is staring at me so intensely, it should make me pause, but all I want is more. More of this look. More of Cassidy. His jaw tightens as he sucks a whistle of breath through clenched teeth.
I'm sorry.
No, I interrupt him. I won't accept an apology for kindness.
Failed kindness, he says, flinching like he's done something wrong.
Cassidy, listen to me, I say earnestly, my palms still flush with the dark blonde bristles on his cheek, savoring the warmth of the skin underneath. No kindness is ever wasted, not on me.
But how will you say goodbye?
I already did, I whisper. I didn't need to bury him here. I just needed to be here.
Hope's words come rushing back to me. Saying goodbye doesn't mean forgetting. Moving on doesn't mean you never loved him. I'm telling you to let go. I'm telling you that you're allowed to be happy.
I run my knuckles over Cassidy's cheek, and he lets his eyes close this time, leaning into my touch, his breath shuddering as I touch him. I can't help running my fingers through his thick, damp hair, but when he opens his eyes and they're so dark with desire, I let my hands fall away from his body and lean back a little so he'll release me. Something intense and exciting crackles between us. It's chemistry. Intense, combustible chemistry. But now isn't the right time to test it. Not here. Not now. Not during this conversation.
His arms, which have been holding me close, lower, and he nods.
I understand.
The strangest thing is, I know he does. Even though he doesn't have the experience I do, I know he understands why we have to stop touching each other right now. And even though I lost my lover and he lost his mother, I know he understands exactly what I'm saying about my farewell to Jem.
What surprises me is the peace that starts in my stomach and warms my whole body like the summer rays of the sun.
There is such profound relief in being understood, in finally being known in the inexplicable way that can come only from empathy, from one broken person fathoming the grief of another. It binds us together in that moment as the sun crests over Katahdin, illuminating his mother's room. My room, with warm, golden light.
As my lips tilt slowly up into a smile, his do the same, and I feel like I am looking at my reflection. Except Cassidy isn't me, and I'm not him. We are bound through understanding. We are bathed in grace. Finally, he looks away from me, taking a deep breath. He sighs, leaning his head to the left, then the right. He must be exhausted after walking all night, but when he looks at me, his face is easy for the first time since our emotional conversation began. He's still smiling at me.
Hungry?
I nod, wiping away the last of my tears and smiling back at him.
Yes.
I'll make us some breakfast,
he says, standing up from my bed.
Cass, I call to him. Just before he leaves my room, he turns to look at me.
Thank you for doing that for me, I say. It means the world to me.
He looks like he wants to say something, but instead he nods. As I hear the sound of cracking eggs and a whisk, I turn my eyes back to Katahdin.
Goodbye, Jem, I say softly. Goodbye.
Then I close my eyes. And for the first time since that terrible night so long ago, I breathe easy.
Chapter 20. Cassidy. I'd do anything for you. The words circled in my head when she thanked me, and I thought about saying them, but something held me back. Something, but what? As I whisk eggs for the skillet, I decide that it's confusion. My emotions are in a tangle, and I need to unravel them before I say things I don't mean, can't mean, wish I could mean. So what exactly are my feelings? Well, I was jealous of Jem when she called out for him in her fever, but then I knew a fierce longing to give her what Wayne had taken away. The chance to make peace with Jem's loss, the opportunity to say goodbye the way she wanted to and needed to. So I was deeply frustrated by failing in my mission to her. I wanted to find that phone and deliver it safely to her. I was angry with myself when I returned home this morning, ashamed to look her in the eyes, lest she see the full extent of my defeat. But my heart changed direction again when I saw her tears, because I cannot bear to see her unhappy, and I ran to her bedside, desperate to right whatever wrong was hurting her, only to learn that she wasn't crying out of pain or unhappiness, not in the way I'd assumed. She was crying because, despite my unsuccessful efforts, she'd managed to say farewell to Jem on her own. And then I knew only desire, near paralyzing, so strong I should have burst into flames while I held her. When she touched my face so tenderly, placing her hand on my cheek, part of me wanted to die, because I knew my life would never get any sweeter than it was in that moment. But even that moment was surpassed by another, by the communion of two hearts that have broken and kept on beating, by the keen and consummate sympathy that is born only from surviving something that almost broke you and recognizing that journey back from hell in someone else's eyes. And that's when I learned something new about myself. My feelings for Bryn are only deepened by the way she makes my blood run hot and my heart beat out of my chest with desire. My body aches for hers, but I am fairly certain that the crux of my growing affection for her is less physical and more profound. The essence of it, despite the chasm of differences between us, lies in understanding. And that meeting of hearts and minds makes her feel far more familiar to me than she should after only a week's acquaintance. I don't know that I've ever mulled the idea of God custom-making one person for another, but if I had wondered, meeting Bryn would almost be enough for me to turn the corner from conjecture to conviction. The sound of screeching brakes in my brain makes me flinch. Porter? Your name is Cassidy Porter? Your father was Paul Isaac Porter? I blink at the eggs, which hiss and pop in the frying pan. She was not custom made for you, Cassidy. No one was made for you. My heart lurches in protest, wanting so desperately to refute this dark claim, but my mind, carefully conditioned for decades, won't allow it. You cannot love her, I remind myself sternly, because no matter how strong your connection or how deep your feelings, you cannot have her. Ever. Especially if you actually care for her. My chest aches with the terrible injustice of it as I slide the eggs onto two plates. Then I brace my hands on the kitchen counter and force myself to lean into the bleak truth and accept it before I pick up the plates and walk back into Bryn's room. I close my book and set it on the coffee table before us, picking up my mug and taking a sip of tea. For the last two evenings, Bryn has insisted on reading in the living room instead of in her bedroom. At first I protested that she needed to stay in bed, but she argued that she could relax and heal just as well on the couch. Envisioning us without an end table between us made me give in a lot faster than I probably should have, but my misgivings weren't warranted. It's worked out fine. I insisted that she still lie down, and she asked if I minded having her feet on my lap. I think there will be very little in my life that I mind less than Bryn's feet on my lap. While I am supposed to be reading, I study them, the delicate lines of her bones and the light blue rivers and tributaries of her busy veins. Since my mental reminder in the kitchen 2 days ago, I've worked hard to reframe my feelings for her into a more manageable context. She is my guest. She is my patient. She is recovering at my house, and when she is fully recovered, we will say goodbye. When I think of things in this way, it's not that it's necessarily easier to accept them, but it's tidy packaging that forces my mind to move on from fruitless wishes for what can never be. "Did you finish already?" she asks, looking up from a prayer for Owen Meany, which she has almost finished. "Yep." "Wow, you were on page one last night." "It's a fast book." "How was it?" I've read every story in Kurt Vonnegut's Welcome to the Monkey House at least 100 times. "Good. As always." Her face is thoughtful as she places Owen on the coffee table beside Kurt.
"Can I ask you something?"
"Anything." She glances at the bookshelves under the window, then back at me.
"One whole shelf is devoted to genetics."
I nod. I already know I don't like where this is going.
Was one of your parents a geneticist?
No. She stares at me, and I know she wants to ask more questions, but I'm hoping if I don't volunteer any more information, she'll choose a different topic.
When did you move here?
She asks, switching gears.
When I was 9,
I say. She nods.
I figured.
How did you figure?
That portrait of you? The one that used to be over the couch? With your mom and dad? That was taken in...
The man in the picture was my grandfather. I blurt out, my voice sharper than I intended, but something won't allow her to believe the face of a man I loved was my dad.
Oh,
she says, leaning back a little, her eyebrows furrowing.
You lived here with your grandfather?
I don't want to talk about this, truly, I don't, but I get the feeling that if I keep hedging her questions, they'll only multiply. I moved here with my mother when I was 9. My grandfather already lived here. My father was... gone.
Gone?
Passed away. It's a slight falsehood. He wasn't killed by another inmate in prison until I was 10, but she doesn't need to know that. Her face registers instant shock.
Oh, no, Cassidy, I'm so...
It's fine, I bite out, standing up and placing her feet back on the couch cushion. I run a hand through my hair before catching her eyes. Do you want more tea?
I shouldn't have asked,
she says, screwing up her face, feeling sorry.
I'm just curious about you.
Why?
Why?
She repeats, looking up at me in surprise.
You saved my life. You nursed me back to health. You live alone here in the middle of nowhere. You're kind, but quiet. You're well-read, but soft-spoken. You manage this whole place with a little solar power, some propane, and batteries. You're interesting. I don't know. I'm curious about you. I want to know more about you.
I gulp, my heart unaccountably swelling from her words, from her interest in me. I tell you what, I'll get us some more tea, and when I come back, you can ask me some questions, okay? She grins up at me.
Any questions?
I don't promise to answer them all, I say, but you can ask. I leave her for a moment, stepping into the kitchen to pull the still warm kettle from the stove and add water to our cups. I don't know why I decided to answer some questions for her, but maybe it's because I want her to know me. Not all of me, of course. Not who I really am. Not whose son I am. But she's still going to be here for a couple more weeks. I don't blame her for wanting a few answers from her host. When I sit down again, I pull her feet back onto my lap and look at her expectantly. What do you want to know?
Okay, first, why did you and your mother move here?
I breathe deep. After my father was gone, my mother didn't feel comfortable living alone in town. We moved here to be with my grandfather.
She didn't want to remarry?
It wasn't really an option. She looks curious but doesn't pursue this answer, and I'm grateful.
Why did your grandfather live all the way out here?
He was disillusioned with society after fighting in Vietnam. He wasn't treated well when he returned, and, well, I grin, just a little, remembering Gramps' fiercely independent nature. He didn't want to be told what to do. He wanted to be free, I guess. He wanted space and peace. He found it here.
I get that,
she says slowly, her eyes locked on mine.
After Jem died, I just wanted to be left alone. It's hard for people to understand that, isn't it? They want to help. They want to be there for you. But sometimes all you need is quiet. Space and peace. And time.
I reach for my mug and take a sip of tea, silently agreeing with her.
When did your grandfather pass?
She asks. 10 years ago.
And you stayed here? You didn't want to move to a town?
I shrug. Not really. I have everything I need here.
Well, not everything,
she says quickly, maybe more to herself than to me. When I glance at her over the rim of my cup, I see 2 spots of red color her cheeks. What am I missing?
Well, She laughs, softly averting her eyes. I mean, she clears her throat. Companionship? I have Annie and the girls. She chuckles again. That's not what I mean. She takes a deep breath. I mean, a girlfriend. A wife? Unless, she cocks her head. Unless what? Unless you don't want that. We stared at each other, deadlocked for a moment. Finally, I look away. It's easier to lie when you're not looking someone in the eyes. I'm content with things the way they are. But you're so... My neck snaps up. So what? She takes a deep breath, holds it, then lets it go. Aren't you lonely, Cass? I shrug, looking out at Katahdin as the setting sun streaks the sky with purple and gold. I'm getting upset because her questions are hitting way too close to the truth, and I'm a bad liar. I'm just not much of a people person, I guess. But what? I don't need anyone. I bark, the strain of lying to her and talking about my past finally getting to me. I'm instantly sorry for yelling. I can feel her hurt and disappointment, flat and awful in the air between us, even though I'm not looking at her. I hold my breath and tell myself it's better this way. The fewer conversations we have about my past, the better it will be for both of us. After a long silence, she speaks again. When do you think I'll be ready to go home? Her question slices through my heart like a hot, sharp knife. I let it bleed for a moment before answering. You're healing well. I should be able to take the stitches out this weekend, I say. But the only way out of here is hiking or taking the ATV over 4 miles of rough ground. Either way, you're going to need another week or two for those incisions to heal. So 2 or 3 more weeks, she says softly. Her voice is so sad, I can't help myself. I turn to face her. With tears brimming in her eyes, she looks back at me, and it hurts so bad that I upset her, I almost don't know how to bear it. Bryn, I don't mean to be such a burden to you, she whispers, looking away as she reaches up to swipe at a tear. A burden? A burden? It reverberates in my head like a dirty word because nothing could be further from the truth. I'm sorry, she says, trying to pull her feet off my lap. But I drop my hands to them, holding them where they are, my breath catching as I feel the skin of my palm pressed deliberately flush with the skin of her feet. I sink into the feeling of touching her, the warmth of her, of those busy blue veins moving her blood, of the bird-like bones and soft skin cradled in my rough, calloused hands. She is an angel, while I harbor the devil inside. But in this moment, in this finite, stolen moment when I should push her away, all I can feel is reverence and gratitude. A burden. The minutes I've spent with her are the greatest gift my quiet life has ever known. I draw her foot up to my face, closing my eyes and pressing my lips to the arc of the soft instep. I rest there for a moment, ignoring the burn in my eyes and surrendering to worship. Her soul. My soul. I wish things were different, I murmur before placing her foot back on my lap. When I open my eyes to look at her, she's staring back at me, her lips parted, her eyes shocked. Cassidy, she says, her voice breaking on my name. Gently I lift her feet, place them back on the old nubby couch, stand up, and walk alone into the dark, cold night.
Chapter 21. Bryn. Here is what I know for certain. I am falling hard for Cassidy Porter. When tears sprang to my eyes last night, it wasn't because he'd yelled at me and pushed me away. It was because I have only 2 or 3 weeks left with him. Being here, in his rustic hideaway, I can feel myself healing, strengthening, the pieces of my jigsawed life coming back together. In the quiet hours while he is working outside, I read his books. Yes, but I have had more space, peace, and time to think than I have ever had before, and in this retreat-like sanctuary with no modern distractions, I am finding myself all over again.
I think about my life before Jem and my life with him. I think about the pain of losing him, and I think about my decision to come here and say goodbye. I think about everything Hope said, and I think about my parents and my friends back in San Francisco. I think about the future and what I want out of life. And I think about Cassidy. No matter how hard I try to impose order on my thoughts, in fact, they always return to Cassidy. I am in awe of him in a way that I can't seem to compartmentalize. If I was 16, I'd call it a crush. But I'm a fully grown woman, and I know it's more than that. I'd be lying if I tried to paint it as less. So I can't get him out of my head. And I've just about stopped trying. There is just so much about him that speaks to me, that draws me to him, that I like, that makes my toes curl. There's the way he carried me down a fucking mountain and sewed up my wounds, and the way he consumes books, the way other men consume sports statistics. There's the way he plays the guitar, so soulfully, you'd swear he was twice his 27 years. Or the way he spent an entire night hiking through darkness to find a phone with a little smudge of blood just because he thought it would help give me closure. He says so little, but still manages to make my heart go berserk with a word or touch. And then, a warm pooling sensation in my stomach makes me moan softly as my eyes flutter closed. There's the way his body looks while he's chopping wood. His back muscles in motion are mesmerizing, the way they flex and bunch, stretch and release. I want to lay my palms flat on them as they move so I can feel the power underneath. He's brutally, scorchingly hot. An actual real-life Adonis, and my long-neglected girl parts go a little wild watching the sun shine down on his tan, sweat-soaked skin. I've been here for over a week, and I know I'm not ready to go. I don't even want to talk about leaving. If anything, I want to tell Stu at Stu's Pools to go fuck himself, have Milo shipped out here, put my house on the market, and just stay. For a while. Indefinitely. I don't know how long. Maybe forever. There's something about this place, and about Cassidy Porter, that heals the roughest, jagged, most wounded parts of me, and I'm desperately unhappy when I think of leaving him and going back to the real world. Why can't this be real? Last night, when he picked up my foot and kissed it, I was so shocked and so aroused. My panties, oh God, his mother's panties were flooded with warm wetness, something that hasn't happened to me in over 2 years. The hairs on my arms stood straight up. My breath caught. My eyes would have been black if I'd looked at them in a mirror. But then, as suddenly as it happened, it was over. He got up and walked away, leaving every cell in my body longing for more, and my mind knotted with confusion. He's attracted to me. I know he is. I can feel it in my toes when his eyes catch mine. I felt it in the way he touched me last night, and a few nights before that when he pressed his lips to my head. His eyes scan my legs, rest on my breasts, trace the curve of my hips. He licks his lips when he gazes at mine like he's hungry and thirsty at once. His eyes darken. His breathing gets shallow and fast. And he's not taken. He's lived here since he was 9 years old. He hasn't had access to another woman. He's free to do whatever he wants with whomever he wants. We're young, but of age. We're untethered to others and attracted to each other. We're all alone out here in the middle of nowhere. If anything, as soon as my stitches come out, it's the perfect setup for 2 or 3 weeks of nonstop sex in every thinkable position. And whatever feelings we might develop for each other, well, while it scares me a little to open myself up to love again, I've missed loving someone. I've missed being loved. I want to be with someone again. I feel like I'm almost ready to put myself out there again, and Cassidy, my sweet, hot protector, seems like the perfect partner. And yet Cassidy, a lone mountain man with no responsibilities except to himself, doesn't seem ready at all. Why does he wish things were different? What needs to be different? Does he fear that his lack of experience will turn me off? Because nothing could be further from the truth. I don't care if he's never been with anyone else. We could spend all summer learning about each other together. Or maybe he was telling the truth when he said that he didn't need anyone. Maybe he isn't lonely. Maybe he truly is happy living off the grid, far from the complications of the outside world, from the mass shootings and the people who disrespected veterans like his grandfather. Maybe these 2 or 3 weeks is all we will have, because it won't hurt Cassidy to say goodbye to me the way it will hurt me to say goodbye to him. His life will just go back to normal, while I already know I will desperately yearn for this place. And for him. My head starts to ache, so I push the covers down, swing my legs out of bed, and walk down the hallway to the bathroom. The floor is wet, which means that Cassidy has taken an indoor shower today, and my mind wanders to dirty places, thinking about what he must look like naked. His body is long and lean, chiseled with muscle. I know this both from sleeping against his chest and surreptitiously watching him swing an axe from the corner of my window. I close my eyes and think back to yesterday afternoon, when he chopped wood for an hour with his shirt off. His hips taper into a sharp V that slides into his jeans, and damn, but that V keeps me awake some nights. I know what it leads to, but I still wonder what the zipper of his jeans is hiding. Opening my eyes with an unfulfilled sigh, I stand up and crank the toilet. Then I wash my armpits, hands, and face in the icy cold water that I'm still not used to. For the first time, as I head back to my room, I realize that I'm not tired and I don't want to go back to bed. My incisions don't ache anymore, and my face looks almost normal again, but for some light yellow discoloration here and there. I'd like to learn more about Cassidy's unusual home, and if he'll let me, I'd like to help out a little, too. I open the top drawer of the bureau against the right wall in my room, and find 2 neat stacks of cotton underwear and bras on one side of the drawer, and a pile of rolled white cotton socks on the other. Choosing a faded, light blue pair of undies and a matching bra, I slip out of my sleeping clothes and pull on the clean undergarments. Opening the second drawer, I find t-shirts, also carefully folded in 2 piles. The one on top is light pink, a V-neck with some frayed threads around the neckline. It looks worn, but soft, and I slip it over my head. Cassidy's mother must have been a bit smaller on top than me, because it pulls across my breasts a little. But a quick check through labels on the rest of the shirts tells me that I'm out of luck for a medium. Good thing cotton stretches. Besides, what other options do I have? I pull open the third drawer to find jeans and denim shorts, all with the elastic waistbands favored by grannies the world over. Again, however, beggars can't be choosers, so I slip a pair of shorts over my legs and tug them up. They fit loosely, doing nothing for my figure, but I'm able to pull them up under my breasts so that the elastic doesn't press against my bandages. What they lack in fashion, they make up for in function, I guess. The fourth and final drawer holds sweatshirts and cardigans, and I pull out a hot pink zip-up sweatshirt that reads, "Maine, the way life should be," and shrug into it. On top of the bureau is a hairbrush with a black elastic twisted around the handle. I brush out a week's worth of snarls, almost grateful for the disgusting buildup of oil that acts as a detangler. I need to ask Cassidy about taking a bath or shower sometime soon. There isn't a mirror in the room for me to check my appearance, but Cassidy has seen me at my worst, so I figure this is at least an improvement on how I've looked since he met me. How I wish I had a little concealer and lip gloss, but I don't think Mrs. Porter was much of one for beauty products. Either that, or they're long gone by now. Padding barefoot across the living room and into the kitchen, I open the tiny refrigerator and take a bowl of eggs from the cool, dark interior. There are only four, so I beat them all in the same bowl, then look around for a frying pan. I find one in the drying rack beside the sink and place it on one of two stovetop burners, but now I'm stumped. I have no idea how to turn it on.
Battery ignition.
I turn at the sound of his voice, a wide smile forming on my face in the moment between hearing him and facing him. Hi, I say, sounding like a middle school girl who just caught a glimpse of her crush in the hall.
Morning,
he says, checking my outfit.
You're dressed.
I hope it's okay that I borrowed a few things. His eyes, which linger on my breasts for a second, eventually slide up to my face. It's got to be pink, because I feel my cheeks flush with warmth from the look in his eyes. He nods slowly.
Sure.
I didn't want to be useless today.
You're not useless. You're healing.
I feel good, Cass. I want to help, to contribute. I don't want to be a burden to you. I figured I could do the cooking.
One, you're not a burden.
His lips quirk up in a slight grin.
Two, can you cook?
Yeah, I say, grinning back at him. I'm not bad.
Really?
He asks, his smile widening, his eyes sparkling.
I haven't. I mean, no one's cooked here but me in a long time, and before that it was Gramp, and he was just as happy with a can of beans warmed up over an open fire.
I cringe. Yuck?
Double yuck, he confirms. What's your specialty?
I thought we'd start easy, with scrambled eggs, I say, holding out the bowl of beaten eggs. I can get more fancy, but I don't know what you have to work with yet.
We could... I mean, if you wanted to, we could go fishing later, if you're up to it.
His tongue darts out to lick his lips, and I'm mesmerized by them for a moment.
Pond's not far.
I clear my throat and look up. I make a mean brown sugar salmon.
Ha!
He sighs, and my insides clench. Damn it, but everything he does turns me on.
I don't have brown sugar, but I've got lots of maple syrup, and I can't get you salmon around here, but we've got yellow perch and brook trout.
I think I can work with that, I say, feeling lighthearted. Whatever you fish, I'll fix. Deal?
Yeah,
he says, stepping forward and reaching around me to turn on the burner under the frying pan.
Deal.
His knuckles graze my hip as he withdraws his hand, and I feel it all the way to my toes. I want to be useful, I say, my voice sounding husky in my ears.
You already said that,
he rumbles, not moving away. My mouth waters. It's true.
Well, okay,
he says, standing so close to me I can smell the soap he uses and the sweat on his skin from whatever chores he was doing this morning.
But don't go too fast, huh?
I'll take it slow. I murmur, and for a split second, holding his eyes as I am, I wonder if we're talking about my recovery or something else entirely.
Slow's good, he says.
Then suddenly he lowers his head and backs away.
I'll wash up outside.
My heart is racing so fast I feel dizzy, but giddy too. I guess I feel gizzy? Turning to face the stove, I grab a wooden spoon hanging from a nail on the wall before pouring the eggs into the pan. The walk to the nearby pond, which Cassidy tells me is called Harrington and is about a tenth of a mile from his homestead, is tougher than I expect. I'm out of breath quickly, and my stitches pull uncomfortably, even though it's a flat, relatively well-worn path, and Cassidy walks slowly and carefully in front of me. But just when I'm about to tell him that I think we should turn back, there it is. A small pond, sparkling and cool under the summer sun. I freeze, taking in the loveliness of it. Barkless trees and high grasses surround the water's edge, and a buzz of cicadas makes for a summer symphony. I breathe deeply as Cassidy turns around to face me.
You want to stop?
I'm just... It's really pretty. He looks over his shoulder at the pond, then back at me.
Small, as ponds go.
On his other shoulder rests a fishing pole, and he carries a bucket and a tackle box in his hand. I don't care. I like it, I say, looking back at the little water hole.
You were out of breath as we walked,
he notes. I nod. There's no use denying it. I guess I'm still healing.
Why don't you take a nap?
He suggests, gesturing to a large glacial rock with his chin. The flat gray surface, bathed in sunshine, is oddly inviting. I bet it's warm.
I'll wake you up after I've caught a dozen.
A dozen? I scoff, taking a couple of steps through high grass to reach the rock.
Well, well,
exclaims Cassidy, who is squatting over his open tackle box and pulling out what appears to be a fly lure.
Do I detect a challenge, Ms. Cadogan?
I lower myself to the rock, 6 or 7 feet away from him, and stretch my legs out before me, leaning back on my palms. My eyes zone in on the bare strip of tan skin where his t-shirt has ridden up. Damn. But he is all man. You think you can catch 12 fish in this little pond? I say.
My record's 26 at this spot,
he says, grinning at me as he stands up to cast his line.
So yeah, I think less than half that is possible.
He's bragging, and it's adorable, but he's also sexy as hell standing there at the water's edge, casting and reeling. For real? I could watch him forever, except that I feel a huge yawn coming on, and my eyes feel so heavy I can barely keep them open. The sun is high and strong, so I shrug out of the hot pink sweatshirt, rolling it into a makeshift pillow.
I'll believe it when I see it,
I tease him, lying back on the rock, the sweatshirt heaven under my head.
What was our deal again, Sassy Pants?
He asks. Sassy Pants. I chuckle softly, eyes closed. You catch 'em, I cook 'em.
You better get some sleep then,
he says, all cocky.
'Cause you're going to have a heap of cooking to do later, Angel.
The sun shines down on my face like a blessing, and I fall asleep, smiling.
Chapter 22. Cassidy. It takes me about 2 hours, but I'm not about to stop until I have an even dozen. And then, just for the hell of it, I catch one more. Maybe to show off a little. I took an hour-long walk in the dark last night, just to cool down after kissing a foot like that. I don't know why I did it. I guess because I felt this desperate, insane urge to prove to her that her presence was an honor, not a burden. But the feelings it conjured up, the way my blood started rushing so hot and fast, my heart pumping it like crazy, the way my pecker stiffened almost painfully. I've never felt these feelings before, but I recognize them instinctively. I'm wildly attracted to her. If we were animals, I'd want to mate with her. Because we're humans, I want to make love to her. Love, a word that keeps entering my mind lately. And I know it's not possible because of promises I intend to keep, but I can't help the way I feel. With my 13th fish swimming around in the bucket, I reel in my line and remove my favorite lure, tucking it back into a safe place in the tackle box. I close and latch the top, then lean the rod against a tree trunk. Moving as quietly as possible, I step through the high grass to the rock where Bryn is sleeping.
Since I've known her, I've probably seen Bryn asleep more than awake. I've had a lot of opportunities to watch her sleep. But not like this. Not with her face turned up to the sunshine, her freckles on full display, her lips slightly parted and tilted upward just a touch. Like she's happy. Like maybe being here with me makes her happy. This is an image that will torture me when she's gone, but I can't force myself to look away because, in my whole life, I've never seen anything as beautiful as this woman. If I didn't know better, and if it was allowed, I might even think that I love her. And there's that word again, I think. I trace the lines of Bryn's face, finally resting on her mouth. I wonder what it would be like to kiss her, to press my lips to hers. They'd be warm from the sun and soft. What would she taste like? How would her body feel in my arms if I clasped her to me as our lips touched? Would I be able to stop after a single kiss, or would I need more? A terrible thought occurs to me, and I wonder if my father ever looked at my mother like this. In fact, Mama could have been wearing that very t-shirt and jean shorts, and my father could have looked at her with desire, with want. I don't know if he loved my mother or not. When I think back, it feels like he did. It feels like they loved each other, as unbelievable as that sounds, because how could he feel one way for my mother and still do what he did to other women? How could he feel love for her, but a few days later, go kill someone else? It scares me. God, it scares me so bad that I lean away from Bryn, searching my mind for indications that my appetites run similar to his. I search and search, but I can't find anything but protectiveness and tenderness for the small, sleeping woman in front of me. "I'd never hurt you," I murmur, the words so soft I can barely hear them. "I'd never hurt anyone." But there is that tiny part of me that isn't convinced, that reminds me of who I am. I don't know what genes lurk inside me, biding their time to make themselves known. Sighing with the bleak unfairness of it all, I reach for her shoulder and shake it gently. "Hey, Angel," I whisper, "time to wake up." For 2 days, we eat all manner of brook trout, cooked up in so many mouth-watering and creative ways, I swear I never knew how delicious fresh fish could be. Bryn wasn't kidding when she said she wasn't a bad cook. We've had fillets with a maple syrup reduction, the whole fish dredged in eggs and flour and fried with fresh herbs, and tonight she made some sort of spicy tomato sauce that caught my mouth on fire, but tasted so danged good on the flaky white meat, I couldn't stop eating. She's taken over my greenhouse, babying the tomatoes and trussing up overgrown herbs. It's come alive under her care and makes me smile every time I step inside. Speaking of smiles, I live for hers. As if on cue, she looks up at me and grins. "You okay? I might have gone overboard with the horseradish." "Is that what's burning my mouth?" I ask, reaching for my glass of water. He asks, after 3 helpings... she says, winking at me. "It was good," I say, leaning back and patting my stomach. "You're going to make me fat." "Impossible. You work too hard to get fat." "How do you stay so little if you eat like this at home?" I ask, replacing my glass. "I don't eat like this at home," she says. "Eating like this is only fun if you're sharing it with someone." I nod, realizing that she learned to cook like this for Jem, probably, then stopped when she lost him. That she would share her skills with me sends a shock of something wonderful through my body. "Thank you," I say, leaning forward to take her empty plate. She cooks and I clean up. It's become our tacit agreement since she took over cooking, the day before yesterday. "Are you still taking out my stitches tonight?" she asks. I stand up and walk the dishes to the sink, where I add them to the bucket of water that holds the soaking pans and bowls Bryn used for cooking. "Yeah," I say, turning to look at her over my shoulder. "Everything looked good this morning. I think it's time." "Will it hurt? I've never had stitches, in or out, and thank God I don't remember most of what happened when they went in." "Nah, you won't even feel them come out. Shouldn't, anyway." "And then I'm finishing Owen Meany," she sighs. "Are you starting a new book tonight?"
Those D batteries have been burning a hole in my bureau drawer because I've been wanting to suggest a movie night for a few days now. The idea of sitting next to her, close to her on the couch while we watch the small TV, has my stomach in good knots. I've read books where a guy and a girl go out on a date to the movies and always wondered what it was like. It's not like I have a right to put my arm around her or anything. I know we wouldn't actually be on a date, just watching a movie. It still gets me a little excited, and I can't decide if that's okay or not. Is it okay to want to sit next to a pretty girl in the dark and watch a movie? I guess it is, as long as it doesn't go anywhere. How about a movie? I ask, staring down at the dishes in the sink, which I wash with a sponge, then rinse in the clean water bucket. She laughs, and I love the sound of Bryn's laughter, but I'm not sure if she's laughing at me or not this time, so I keep my back to her, concealing my flushed cheeks.
Wait, really? Can we?
She asks, and my shoulders, which are rigid, relax because I can hear the excitement in her voice. Sure, I have a portable VHS player, a little TV to hook it up to, batteries.
I saw your collection of movies, but I assumed you kept them out of nostalgia.
I shake my head and glance around at her. Nope. We can watch one. If you want.
Yeah, she says. I'd love it. A little technology fix.
I rinse another plate and add it to the drying rack. She's told me a lot about the internet since she's been here. And though it's hard for me to completely get my head around it, I love the notion of information at my fingertips. Someday I'd like to give it a try, all this technology she talks about. Do you have one in mind? I ask. A movie?
You're killing me, Smalls,
she says, giggling softly behind me. I feel a smile split my face and whip my head around to look at her. The Sandlot? You know it?
Cass, we're only 3 years apart. Of course I know it. Every kid in our generation knows it.
She blinks at me.
Even you?
I played baseball when I was little.
Oh, yeah?
I nod, remembering the day I hit a home run for my little league team. It was the summer before my father was arrested, before my whole world changed. And it was before the day I met Bryn Cadogan, the best day of my life. Yeah, little league.
Before you moved here.
The pan she used to make the tomato sauce needs a little more elbow grease, and I lay into it with a Brillo pad, remembering Mama's face as I rounded the bases. My father was out on the road, as usual, but she sat in the bleachers watching. She was so proud of me, her winning little man. And then the whole team hoisted me on their shoulders, and we got our picture taken for the North Country Register. We didn't end up winning any more games, but for that day, we were champions. Yeah, I say, realizing that she's waiting for an answer. When we lived in town.
When your dad was still alive?
I clench my teeth and swallow hard, transferring the pan into the rinse water. I hate the way she calls him my dad, so casually. He was never ever my dad. He was, unfortunately, my biological father. Yeah.
You are not a man of many words, Cassidy Porter, she says, her voice exasperated. Don't you have any good stories to tell me?
Good stories. No, not many, sweet Bryn. Finished with the dishes, I pour the soapy water down the drain and put the bucket on the floor. I'll take it outside and dump it later. Then I slide the rinse water bucket over to where the soap bucket was. I add a little soap to it so it's ready for tomorrow's dirty dishes. Then I turn to Bryn. Some stories have really bad endings. She stares at me from where she's still sitting at the square four-person table.
Do you have a bad story inside of you?
She has no idea how close her words come to the truth. I flinch.
Oh, but Cassidy, we all have bad stories inside of us, she says, her voice gentle as she stands up and takes a step toward me.
Not like mine. Not as bad as mine. She searches my eyes and takes another step toward me, reading my gaze astutely.
Yes, we do. Jem was murdered. That night the cops came to my door to tell me. One of the worst nights of my life. A horror story if there ever was one. It's on the tip of my tongue to say that the night the cops came to my door was the worst night of my life, too. But I'd be opening a can of worms that I don't ever want to open with my Bryn. My hands are on my hips, but she reaches out for one of them, curling her small fingers around mine and pulling my hand into hers. As always, her touch sends longing galloping through my body like a herd of wild horses, making my heart thunder, making every nerve ending in my body clamor for more.